Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it is the 23rd of September 2010. And so we have got a ton of questions today since I missed last week, and I apologize for that. We were doing a presentation over in Houston, and I had not put everything on my calendar. So it's not Erin's fault. It was my fault. She kindly covered for me. I thought it had been canceled, and she wrote and said, I assume since you're in Houston, you're not doing this right now. And I said, oops. So thank you for your patience with me. So let's just get on with the questions. Unfaithful partner wants to reconcile. I'm the unfaithful partner, and I've done tons of reading on your site and so many others, and usually it seems that usually it's the unfaithful partner who wants to reconcile and hold the marriage together. My situation is completely the opposite. I recognize that I was terribly wrong, and I want to reconcile, but I feel like I'm fighting against the odds right now because my husband has moved out and really wants to sever contact. He says he has no desire to work on our relationship. He doesn't want to go to counseling or join ARC. He says he doesn't want to be dragged back into the path I caused with my infidelity. He says he can't hear my voice, come home to our home, or look at me or the dogs without feeling extreme pain. I struggle with codependency, so it's really difficult for me not to call him or email him all the time. I haven't done that to my own amazement, however. I do have to occasionally contact him about matters related to the home that we own together, bills, etc. How do I make these communications more effective and not drive him farther away? I feel like I'm swimming upstream and just want to scream. He's scheduled for deployment early next year, and I hope we don't have to leave things so angry. What if something does happen? I could never live with myself. I don't want to sound contradictory because I want to trust God and his timing, but is there anything I can do here? For some people, the pain is so incredibly extreme that the reminder really is difficult. And, you know, I think that, you know, how do I make communications effective? Certainly, I think you let him know, believe it or not, that you're going to be just fine. And you let him know that, you know, God's going to take care of you. If you appear, I think, to him to be really needy in this situation, then that's certainly probably not going to be something that would be appealing to him anyway. I think if you haven't made amends, I certainly would do a good job of doing that. I would be appreciative. Let him know you really appreciate the fact that he listens to you. You can ask at points if he wants to know what you're doing in terms of your own recovery. He may or may not. You know, it's one of those things you probably don't have a lot of control over. Usually I find that it takes time, and I don't think you mentioned how far out from ground zero you are, but it oftentimes takes a lot of time for that pain to begin to go down, for them to begin to gain perspective and look at this from a realistic point of view. And you know, all you can do right now is focus on your own recovery so that if something does happen, you've done enough of your own healing. And, you know, hopefully he's going to, at some point, face this and deal with it. I think one of the difficult things that happens that I've seen before is that for some people, it's like the pain is so extreme that they're almost afraid to look at it and to try to understand it. They tend to stuff it and avoid it, and they use kind of avoidance as a way of handling the pain. As long as I don't see you or think about you, I don't have to deal with it. The problem with avoidance in the long run is that stuff tends to come back up over time. And people who previously have had post-traumatic stress disorder will sometimes respond like that. You can encourage him to, at the very least, maybe try to get his own help for this. Telling is not necessarily even about reconciling. You just want him to be whole. And in that sense, you know, just be concerned about his healing. At the same time, I wouldn't put pressure on him. And simply because that's going to, if he feels demand, it'll drive him away. So again, just being strong in your own sense, working your own recovery. When he does speak with you, just say, I appreciate you talking to me. And, you know, there's not a lot you can do at that last question. Is there anything I can do here? In reality, the person who wants the relationship the least always has the most power. And for whatever reason right now, he doesn't know what he wants. So I would pray for him. And I hope other people listening to this will pray for him. And someday he'll back up and look at this and see if there's, you know, maybe recognize that there's somebody there that he would want to be with. Your own healing, being attractive and strong in your own way and being appealing in that sense, not in the way of seductive, that's not what I mean, but just your own healthiness in the long run will make him, healthiness, I don't know if that's a word, but your own recovery may make you very attractive to him. So I would certainly do that. And best of luck with all of that. So next question, adult child and alcoholic. Is it normal for an adult child to minimize the dysfunction of their childhood and how it shaped them, or to just be totally clueless that it was dysfunctional until they get into therapy? I want to know better what happened to me in my childhood that was healthy or unhealthy. Is that possible? I would like a clearer picture. The reality of my childhood seems very shifty and unclear. My family goes up and down whether my dad really is even an alcoholic. He's a functioning alcoholic, which makes it more confusing. Why does this make me feel crazy? I just started a book called How to Love an ACOA. It says we are used to on-again, off-again relationships. It says we seek dramatic, addictive type of romantic relationships and fear a real, secure, steady relationship is boring. What makes grown-ups growing up with an addict parent an on-again, off-again relationship? Why do we seek out similar relationships as adults? It's a really good question. First off, I would have suggested you want to learn more. There's a lot of good writing, and so I'm glad you're reading that book. That's a very good start. I think one of the problems with dealing with growing up in that sort of family is, as we've mentioned before, you play roles. And it never really is about having a meaningful relationship in typically, issues aren't addressed as long as everybody plays their role. The system can ultimately survive because there is a great deal of chaos at times in those sorts of families. A normal relationship can seem incredibly boring. You want to know why are you clueless? You know, it's funny. You can't even define or describe a color to a blind person. And I think when you grow up in a situation where it's just the norm, unless you really have a lot of interactions where you're closely, I think, tied inside other families, it really does not seem abnormal to you. It's kind of like the frog in the water. If denial of the problem was always kind of the rule, where everybody pretends they're normal when they're really not, I wouldn't really expect things to be any different over time. It denial is a wonderful thing. And when we talk about pretend normal here at Affair Recovery, a pretend normal isn't nearly as much about how we present ourselves to the world as whether or not we're really able to accept our own personal issues and our own defects of character? Are we able to see that maybe there's something wrong with us, take responsibility for that, or just accept it and begin to do something about it? And if in an alcoholic family, if nobody ever did that to begin with, then probably the crazy person would be the one who thinks that it should be different. I mean, why would they change unless somehow that event happened that made them begin to step back and finally admit that they're powerless? For someone whose parent has been an alcoholic, like for most alcoholics or most addicts, until they come to the place where they hit bottom, little or nothing will change. Hopefully in this situation, eventually, he will kind of begin to see the problem and change. Again, the problem is nobody else is going to be able to do it for him. It's something he's got to do for himself. So the next question. Kinds of addicts. Is a functioning alcoholic not as destructive to their family as an out-of-control open alcoholic? I feel guilty because my dad is only a functioning alcoholic. Actually, only a few people ever believe or can tell that he is an alcoholic. It makes things even worse because it's such a big family secret and feels more isolating. How is it he's so good at controlling how others perceive him? He's a master manipulator, I should know. I follow in his footsteps. And why won't my mom tell anyone? She won't talk to anyone about it. She says she can. Of course, my dad says he doesn't have a drinking problem in the first place. It makes me feel crazy. Am I crazy? Is my mother not crazy? Is he trying to manage our perceptions too? Okay. So, again, with pretend normal, you know, probably it's what he actually believes. I think that in our own self-deception, you know, we won't get honest with ourselves because it would be too painful or maybe too shameful. So for that reason, they don't ever really look at it. And, you know, I would say that a functioning alcoholic certainly is as destructive, only because it makes you feel maybe if like you're more insane. In other words, if you have somebody who's just a huge binger and they disappear and, you know, for weeks on end and, you know, lose it and you have to go pick them up in a bar, that sort of situation, you know, it's kind of like it's very clear that you see their problem. But it's a lot more subtle with somebody who's kind of a what we call a maintenance drinker. And even though a lot of the problems are the same, it makes, I think, the person in the relationship feel a lot crazier simply because they go, you know, is it real? Is it not? So you get into the whole questioning mode. So I do think it's more difficult. You know, it takes only one person to ultimately change a relationship. And when you talked about your mom not telling, I would just say that for her to tell would unilaterally change the relationship and create a tremendous amount of turmoil. I mean, I understand potentially why it's a homeostatic relationship. It's what's worked for them for forever. And unless there's a serious illness, cirrhosis of the liver, DWI, unless those things begin to occur, then in reality there probably won't be any change. But hopefully at some point, you know, that one event will happen that causes them to begin to hit bottom and have to really look at the issue. Because as long as someone can continue to cope and feel like they're still master of the universe and they still feel like they can manage it, then ultimately they're never going to admit they have the problem. Spiritual leaders. It's an interesting question. Why does God call husbands to be spiritual leaders and the wives to submit? Women make good spiritual leaders too. And why not? Why do we have to submit? I hate that word. It sounds unequal. I understand respecting your husband, but submit? That's been so abused by men. How can this not feel degrading like a dog on a leash? It sounds so antiquated and not necessary for a healthy marriage. Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll answer that as best I know how. And it really has to do a little bit with how we image God. And so I can only answer this one from a theological perspective. But in the long run, if you look at the Trinity or the concept of the Trinity, there's this eternal exchange of love between the Father and the Son, and from that proceeds the Holy Spirit, that ultimately there's just this movement of love between two beings. The love initiates from the Father, goes to the Son loves back in return. And so the Bible begins with a marriage and the Bible ends with a marriage. It is the visible metaphor of ultimately what the inner workings of the Trinity are about. So in the husband's role, you know, he is as Christ is to the church, as it talks about in Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united with his wife, and the two shall become one. He says, you know, this is profound mystery in Ephesians 5, but I'm really talking about Christ and the church. Right before that, it says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. The husband's role in a marital relationship from a theological perspective is to be that of Christ toward the church. He is absolutely to love her and be willing to lay his life down for her. The wife's submission, her mission under his mission, is to let him love her. Now, submission does not mean it's not a hierarchical, like I think we think about it, it's not a hierarchical term. I submit to the government, governmental authorities. All that means is I respond in such a way as to allow the government to carry on their role. I don't oppose them in their role. That term leader, spiritual leaders, is far better translated, they're to be a servant leader if they're to love as Christ loved. It's not a dictator. It's really a laying oneself down and loving and serving another person. So in a sense, you know, if I'm getting in the car and I'm sitting over behind the steering wheel, a lot of times I'll look out and Stephanie will be standing by the passenger door waiting for me to come and open the door for her. And I'll roll the window down and I'll say, what are you doing? And she'll say, I'm submitting, you know, because what she's doing is she's allowing me or helping me to fulfill the role that ultimately God has called me to, which is to love her, to be a servant leader. So, you know, in that sense, that is submission. Because submission, again, is just whatever a way you respond. And it's submit one to another, by the way. It's the way that you respond to each other that allows you to carry out the function of the role that you have within that relationship. It's almost being the wind underneath the wings of one another. And I don't know, you know, if it's really that lousy to be in the role of being loved. Maybe it is. But that's ultimately what it's speaking about, is just your submission. It's that mission under his mission is to ultimately let him love you and to help facilitate that. And in terms of being a servant leader, certainly I think that we do have dominion, and you are probably a good spiritual leader. There's nothing wrong with that either. But maybe that helps clarify a little bit of what submission is about. So, do you think infidelity is damaging only from a Christian biblical point of view, or do you think it's damaging regardless of religious teachings? In the Old Testament, men had multiple wives. I would have been a horrible Old Testament wife. Some couples seemingly didn't find it to damage to have sex outside of marriage. Personally, I was on the fence about this stuff until I found out my spouse was having multiple affairs. It had a solidifying impact on my position that monogamy was part of the committed relationship and that infidelity caused a pain so great I can't even describe it. So, no, I think infidelity it's not just from a Christian perspective. Infidelity is flat out damaging in almost any given relationship. I think value systems and how people define monogamy, if they're on the same page from the same culture, some things are more acceptable. The expectations are different according to some cultures. But anytime there's a violation of what you know your mate wants or believes, and you unilaterally do that, and there's that keeping of secrets, I don't care what culture you're from, what age, it always creates that trauma wound, that attachment distress, and it creates a primal panic in us because, you know, it just shatters a sense of our identity because we do make those attachments. So it is certainly not just something from a Christian perspective. Now, Christians may have, or Muslims or Buddhists, certain understandings of what monogamy means and friendships, and those will be driven, those theological systems may have a lot to do with how people see and understand the roles of women, the roles of men, expectations. But overall, once those roles are broken, regardless of where you come from, there will be that shattering and that breaking, and it's really painful. So, next question. My spouse is a recovering sex addict from Europe. We've been talking about what we want to teach our son about sex, or but in other words, that casual sex is wrong. Responsible sex with love as a late teen or young adult is acceptable. I've had many sexual partners and truly do not believe they help me at all, and I could have erased them all and been much happier and healthier. None of my past experiences compared to making love with my husband, nor did I gain any experience that I could not have learned with him. But I learned all of this through my own experiences. What are your thoughts? It does seem cruel to ask young adults to suppress their sexual desire until they marry, which stays usually late 20s or 30s, not realistic. It can't be healthy. My opinion is it really goes back to what I was talking about maybe in one of the previous questions, which is attachments are so incredibly powerful. When we began to be sexual, I think that we naturally begin to form attachments, or we'll end up being sexual with no attachments and in many ways separate our sexuality in some ways from our relationships. I also see that as very damaging. In the long run, I guess my belief system is, you know, that union is really made as a metaphor, again, from a theological perspective. It's made for a connection between a couple. It's an act of love, an attachment, a bond. It's a place where I hope it's imaging the very love of God. It's a free, total, faithful, fruitful love that we come together with. I think that it's difficult outside of a committed relationship, you know, a marital relationship, to truly image love, where there's, again, that free, total, faithful, fruitful love. I mean, it can't be total if it's you're not at that place where you're willing to give yourself totally to another person or your life. It can't be fruitful. In other words, certainly don't want children coming along, and that's one of the aspects of making love. To me, children can be a piece of that, and that even happens accidentally. Until you're ready to accept that responsibility, I think you need to be careful. Is it difficult in this culture, I think, to go till your late 20s, early 30s? Yeah, it'd be incredibly difficult. Apart from the grace of God, I don't even know how you would do that. But I think the standard is still the standard. I mean, to me, if it's not about a renewal of vows, I mean, to me, very much, the whole lovemaking aspect is about a renewal of vows. It's about the covenant that we made as husband and wife to come together. It's a commemoration of that in many ways, a celebration of that, an incredible expression of that. You know, when I look at rape, I don't see rape as being, as imaging true love or the love of God. It's not free, total, faithful, fruitful. It's not necessarily in the best interest of another person, for sure. I don't see child abuse as that. Even, you know, extramarital sex or sex outside of marriage to me is still not total in the sense that it's not an expression, a renewal of those vows. It's not about a celebration of the oneness that we've become as husband and wife. So I guess because of the way I look at it in terms of a metaphor, I do believe it's something that is far better off saved until marriage. Now, that being said, just let me add one more thing quickly. The other problem is if people, though, have a really kind of constricted view of what sexuality is about that comes from maybe religious upbringing. The problem is within a marriage, they may tend, instead of letting it be an expression of who they are and an expression of love, they may find that it becomes more of a role that they have to begin to play because there's these now these expectations of what sex is. So I see that as a real negative. So hopefully, you know, people have a strong understanding that it's really about an expression of who you are as a human being, an expression of who you are as a man or a woman, and that it is one of the most amazing things that we get to participate with in this life. So hopefully that answers that particular question. That was a tough one. Let's see. Next question. I grew up with an elite, hottie-based spirit teaching of Christianity. I was raised being taught that those who do not physically profess they believe in Jesus Christ as only the Son of God are going to go to hell. Do you agree with that? It seems so harsh and unfair. If you happen to be born and raised in a Muslim nation or in the middle of Africa, can God possibly be this way? He can't be sending two-thirds of humanity to hell because they've not said the specific name or creed, a specific name or creed. Isn't God written on our hearts? I want to grow closer to God. I grew up as a Christian. It's familiar, comforting in many ways. I get stuck and feel disconnected whenever I hear a Christian condemn all Buddhists, agnostics, etc. to hell. It seems to me very upsetting to hear Christians speak proudly of us versus them language. Aren't we all children of God? Is God really so small that he needs organized religion to touch his children? So, first off, I think God is love. And when people speak us versus them language and it's not rooted in love, but instead rooted in pride, I think they're 180 degrees off base. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think that God looks at hearts. You know, it says in Romans chapter 1 that all that may be known about God has been made clear through what has been created. And so I certainly don't think that God goes and takes pleasure or even tries to condemn people to hell. I think he looks to see, you know, who and how are we actually living? What are we living for? Are we living for ourselves? You know, I think that to me, what makes it difficult, though, apart from the teachings of Jesus, is ultimately what we live for and how we live. I do think that we're regenerate, but again, we serve a God of grace. I don't know how to talk about some of that. I know that God desires that none should perish. And So in that sense, again, I think I don't believe that those other people of other nations that have never heard, I think that God is just and loving and caring for them. So I don't sit there and say that doesn't work for them. I mean, I don't know what God's going to do one way or the other. I feel incredibly fortunate to have a relationship with the Lord. And I know that it's about grace and getting what I don't deserve. And it's about, to me, a transformation, literally becoming something new. And I think a lot of times when it comes to Jesus, you know, we think a lot about Jesus as a man trying to show us how to be a spiritual being, but also think that Jesus was a spiritual being trying to teach us how to be a man, which is one of the reasons I think his teachings are so important. You know, anything to me that is true religion will always be paradoxical, that the way up is always the way down, that the first will be last. If you want to gain your life, ultimately you lose your life. It's not about anything that we do. Ultimately, in this system, it's not about karma to me. It's really about accepting a system or joining a system where I get credit for everything I never did. So in that sense, I think that what Jesus teaches is imperative. I don't know that I've answered your question. I do think that, as he says, I am the way and the truth and the life. That part in me could never change. But again, how God responds to people who've never had that choice to make, I know my God to be loving. So I don't know how to answer all your questions on this one. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it. It's a great question. Pornography. My spouse said that while acting out, pornography was not even sexually exciting. Now, I find it exciting too. Why would he watch it then if it wasn't exciting? He said he doesn't remember it even being exciting, even when he first started 10 years ago. How do you get turned on and hooked then? He also said that having sex with prostitutes was not sexually exciting either. He was not sexually attracted to them, nor did he have any of those good sexual feelings most people have when they're about to have sex. Again, what's there to get addicted to then? He also associated sex with shame and guilt, but not with me, minus the guilt of the affairs, he said. I'm the only woman he's actually been attracted to and happy with. Happy to have sex with. All I can say is this whole thing is amazingly complex, and a lot of people end up obsessed with things that they don't know why they have that compulsion, but as we've talked about before, addiction oftentimes is very much about a compulsion. Sometimes it happens more out of an expectation. Sometimes it happens for deeper-seated reasons, from sexual abuse all the way to passive-aggressive. I think each case is very individual, but there are addictions of choice, and the choices we make don't necessarily have to be pleasurable choices. I mean, I've got one person I worked with for a long time that was a very serious overeater, addicted to food. And I can tell you she hated eating. She didn't like eating. The only reason she ate was ultimately to gain weight, to hurt her father. But it was an addiction of choice. Eventually, you know, at first we eat to live, and then we live to eat. And that became true for her. And so why people initially start, I think, is fairly individualistic. But over time, because of that choice, it can become something much larger and consuming for them. So next question here. Getting a better marriage after infidelity. I know that many say their marriage was the best it ever was after they made it through the pain of the infidelity together. My husband and I have been working on our marriage on and off, his choosing to start and stop, for the last 6 months. We've been dealing with the affair discovery for over a year. He ended it and said, prior to me finding out, I'm still so hurt because I still feel like he doesn't want to be honest with me about things. He says that he's told me everything that he can remember of what he says about that 4 to 5 month emotional affair and nothing more. He offered to get a GPS on his phone to help me trust him again. He took it back and said it was like I was placing restrictions on him by checking up on what he says and where he is. He's reading a book on and off. He's a recovery addict and in full addiction during the affair. He is attending about one meeting a week. He's much more affectionate with his words and tells me that he now realizes he loves me and never wanted to lose his family. But I still have trouble looking at him with the same love that I once had for him. How could he lie to my face for so long about porn, emailing women, seeing someone else, drugs, alcohol, when he loved me? He is trying at a small percentage of things and making progress slowly, but I'm scared. Is this as good as it's going to get? And will I ever reach that wonderful new marriage stage? Any suggestions to help? You know, ultimately, there's a kind of a mutuality or a mutual submission. Conditional recovery, to me, is probably a bit of a recipe for potential relapse. And, you know, when someone is being defensive, I always feel like, when someone's being defensive, it's always kind of at their point of pride. I suspect that, you know, he may still be dealing some with his own denial about who and what he is, and may still be having trouble fully accepting all of what he is. It's really never about a pursuit, I think, in the long run to save the marriage. It's really about a pursuit to become ultimately someone of character that doesn't lie, that doesn't cheat, someone who, you know, has a direction in life besides their own selfish gratification, who really wants to love, someone who, you know, respects themselves, and maybe somebody who you could really respect. Far too often in recovery, what I see are people who ultimately don't want to lose something, but I wonder if they really want to become a new creation, if they want to become something different, if they really want to change, or if they just want to maintain the status quo. When we talk about marriages becoming something much grander than they ever were before, it's because I think people within that relationship not only recognize maybe what they've had or what they have in that relationship, but even more so they recognize what they're not. And they begin to make efforts to be safe, efforts to maybe learn how to love, efforts in terms of their own character. They're growing, they're becoming something new. Not wanting to be that other person, not wanting to, and again, not wanting, it's not quite the right words here, but certainly not wanting to repeat that, and doing what's necessary for them to be whole, for them to be safe. They take responsibility for it. Half efforts avail us absolutely nothing. And, you know, I don't know, it feels to me a little bit like these are kind of half steps, half-hearted. Again, not wanting to lose something. I don't know him. I can't judge. But I certainly hope that as he's with other people, going to that one meeting a week, that maybe he can be inspired by other people who are, you know, literally just ripping their hearts open and their lives open for others to see, you know, setting the example, setting the pace, showing what it looks like to be rigorously honest, breaking out of that pretend normal and learning how to look at themselves, hopefully through that testimony and watching those other people, you know, he'll catch fire and deal with that. Apart from that, though, I think it's very, very difficult for you to be able to have a lot of encouragement and hope. So hopefully he's going to come to that place where he will do that. What's the right thing? I've been struggling with trusting my husband again. He's told me so many lies over the years about the affair, online porn, drugs, alcohol, where he is, how he's now sober from drugs and alcohol and blames that for his ability to so easily forget the past. But he's lied while sober over the past 10 months. So he was checking in with me from phones where he was to show that he was where he said he was. He used to call from his cell phone and lie, so now he uses reliable people's phone lines. One day recently, when we were out of the office, which is when he saw her before he said he would check in, he said that he would check in. He didn't do that until after his therapy session at 6 p.m. He said he'd been out of the office all day and then lied to her. He used her phone to call me to show he was there. He lied once about having a session with her. She asked that he not use her office phone anymore to call me. She didn't want to get in the middle of this. But shouldn't she be teaching him to be truthful and trustworthy and teaching him to do this? If he says he lies about things still, and I'm still trying to believe him, then I need to be made sure that his words are true. You posted this. I love it when my words come back and haunt me. The 7 most common mistakes therapists make. Discouraging the client from being truthful. Infidelity is the act of keeping secrets. Intimacy is a willingness to be fully known. Therefore, infidelity inhibits intimacy. It's impossible to be loved unconditionally if you only conditionally let another person know who you are. Admittedly, disclosure needs to be limited to the relevant details. Not too much detail. Too much detail increases the probability of intrusive thoughts. But discouraging truth not only inhibits intimacy, it robs the hurt spouse of their choice. The unfaithful mate can never regain trust unless they first trust their mate with the information. Is this right to not let him call me to teach him how to be trustworthy? Well, I don't know that she's trying to teach him not to be trustworthy. I think that, and you don't fully know what the conversation was between them. I certainly have had that happen before in my practice. She may have suggested other things for him to do. What concerns me is, in order for us to begin to trust another person, there has to be about a 90% consistency rate. You know, like you had said, you know, I would think there are easier ways to kind of let you know kind of where he is if that's a problem. But even then, the question gets to be, it's kind of the why we do things. Is that something he's doing because he wants to do it? Is it something he's doing because you want him to do it? We never fall over the what. We always fall over the why we're doing it. And the problem with with a system where it's really kind of not his program and it's not what he wants to do, is ultimately he's going to get tired and weary if he's doing it kind of by flesh and not by spirit. If it's something he's doing it from kind of his own self-effort rather than from a heart's desire. So, you know, I would just hope over time that he's going to recognize his own need, that ultimately he comes up with a program and kind of shares with you what he believes he needs to be doing, and he's really consistent with that. Again, I don't know whether his therapist is in any way teaching him not to be honest. She may be teaching him or telling him something that he needs to be doing that he's not, too. I don't know if it would be even helpful at some point, maybe for the two of you, if she'd be willing to meet the two of you to, so that maybe you can answer a question and talk to her directly. It couldn't hurt to ask. Let's see here. Stopping the protest focus. We just finished the lesson in Beyond EMS series on the protest POCA. It hit the nail right on the head for us. Your explanation of the cycle of protesting withdrawing is totally yes. My question is this. What are some practical ways to stop the dance before it starts or ends in both parties feeling disconnected? My husband, the unfaithful, says that he doesn't feel connected to me. I know that there are other issues there, but I'm beginning to see how my reactions to arguments and issues may be part of what makes him feel disconnected. I am a protester question asked, and he's the withdrawer. Any suggestions? Well, first off, I think that my recommendation is learn to be keenly aware of the dance the two of you do. When you see the dance beginning, I think it's important to kind of call it and say, oops, there it is. There's our old pattern. And then I think you come up with a intervention, and as you go through Beyond EMS, we'll cover this, but you go through an intervention where you, not an intervention, maybe a plan of how you plan on addressing it when you begin to see it. I like using the sheet of feelings, the softer feelings. I'm not sure if we've covered that yet in the lessons you're doing, but you just sit down and you start just talking strictly about feelings, not about what the event is. You know, you might just say, right now, you know, because of this, I'm feeling, and you share those feelings. And then the other person has an opportunity to respond to the feelings. You can always argue about opinions and what happened and what was reality, but you can never really argue about those feelings. The feelings are what the feelings are. So hopefully, if you will do a little different conversation, like have that emotional conversation where you just begin talking about the feelings, that would probably help a lot if he's willing to sit down and have a face-to-face about feelings versus about actually what happened. If you talk about what happened, you drive yourselves farther apart. You'll just be each trying to make your own point or withdrawing. But maybe if he can sit there and see the value of just listening to your feelings and responding to those, it may not be as threatening to him. You might even start, since he's the one that withdraws in this thing of, you know, how does he feel at that moment? What are his feelings just about even talking? And then you can let him know how you feel about his feelings, not in a sense of that he's wrong for his feelings, just sit there and just allowing him to be heard and expressing, you know, your concern for him may help him be able to stay engaged and continue on in the process. But stay with the program because that whole issue will be talked about more in the future. Okay, here's another question on adult children of alcoholics. Why do adult children of alcoholics stay on the peripheral of social gatherings. I read this in one of my books. It's true for me and ACOA. I don't like that. I'm this way. Never knew it was a classic symptom of being an adult child and alcoholic. You know, and it is partially because the ACOA system is what we call enmeshed, and so there's a really strong boundary around the system, and so in that sense, it's like it's an us and them. There's such a strong sense of us that when you're in a social gathering, a lot of times it's almost like you never really learn the skill of how do you just be you outside of the family. When you're outside the family, you're still playing the role of the family. So it's difficult to be involved outside the family. It's almost like you're on the outside looking in, because the sense of having to be part of that family identity is so intense. And so it just naturally leads to someone not being able to join a group or gatherings and really connect, because that requires kind of doing relationships, and it's almost seen as disloyal to the family. So you've got to stay somewhat more family-centered or oriented than you would group-centered or oriented. Why does the dysfunction start to show up in our young adult years? Why do adult children of alcoholics have similar issues as my spouse, who had an abusive mother and was emotionally abandoned by both parents? Well, I think the symptoms begin to show up long before our early adulthood. I think it just becomes more and more apparent as time goes on how you end up doing life, and sometimes just the way that relationships go for you begin to highlight that. You know, as long as you're still in the family system, you're not going to notice it simply because it's the way the family system is. But there are other types of dysfunction besides alcoholic families that still, again, play with the dynamic of roles rather than learning how to do real relationships and learning how to share real feelings. So, you know, you'll go into adulthood, I think, oftentimes you know, just with a way of learning life, you know, just like it takes those roles, like your husband who says, you know, if he was abandoned by kind of both parents, then you can only imagine, you know, they've kind of played by the same rules that the alcoholic family does, and so they just carry the same symptoms and the same traits. Feeling hopeless. We've been doing really well in recovery the past couple of months since my discovery of my mate's affair. We had a normal married couple fight yesterday, and it escalated into a bit of a protest polka. I was feeling hopeless about myself, unloved, guilty for not being perfect, and I started questioning whether or not I can believe that he never wanted to leave me for his affair partner. He was accusing me of similar flaws that he used to write to her as reasons why he could never be happy with me and wanted to be with her, but was stuck with me. I'm trying to be objective and see if he is correct in his accusations of me. How can I tell if it's a real issue I have or his own issue being projected on me or him just being mean during a fight? I cried during the affair, during and after, which is unlike me. Congratulations, that's good. What hurt me most wasn't even related to the fight, but his attack against me personally that brought up all the insecurities about whether he really loved me or could love me with imperfections, or if anyone could really love me if his accusations are true. By the way, even that question would say that for you, love is still based on being conditional. It's never love, I want to say, unless the other person doesn't deserve it. So even if they're true, you know, you have to be a little bit jacked up to know that someone really loves you. If you were perfect, they would just want you because you're perfect. You know, if you're imperfect and they still love you anyway, that love carries some weight. I feel hopeless about myself, and being a woman, a man can love. Well, at the first part of the question, when you just said that part of old patterns, you know, we can always go back into the ruts that we had once been in. The biggest work that couples do over time as they kind of find a new way of being together is relapse prevention and then stopping old patterns. It sounds like when you got into the fight yesterday that you certainly went back into old ways of being and old ways of relating with each other, even though you did some things different, like crying during and after, which I want to applaud you for. It means that it's not as much about being perfect. But it's interesting. I feel so hopeless about myself and being a woman a man can love. You know, I think you become and you try to be the woman who you are. You don't try to be a woman that your idea of what that woman is. You want someone who loves you for who you are, not what you might be able to become or what your potential is. If your husband isn't able to see the incredible love that you've displayed toward him and the patience you've exhibited toward him, then, you know, in the long run, you know, if he's just with you because you're everything he wants, I would say that's pretty shallow. At the same time, you have to be able to look at you and decide, you know, it's not what he says. I mean, you can look at what he says, but and take it with a grain of salt, but at least kind of pray about it and see and talk with other people and get feedback. I mean, I always want to know those areas that, you know, maybe that I have to look at my own character development, because there are certainly places that I would say I have yet to be conformed to the image of love. So with that, it looks like we're out of time. And I want to thank everybody for joining the call today. Lots of questions, and I'm sure we'll have a bunch more questions next week. I got behind, but maybe we can catch up next week. We'll see. So I hope everybody has a good week, and be praying for you guys to healing. Bye-bye.